Chapter 8, War Years. The first snow of the season was gently falling on Hamilton as the janitor turned on the lights in Memorial Chapel for the Sunday Vesper service and greeted the guest pastor, William F. Davison, class of 1923, whose early December sermon, Home for Christmas, was a knowing nod to students facing only 10 days of class before the winter break. But Reverend Davison found himself in front of a distracted and unsettled congregation. In the hour or so before the 4 p.m. service, the campus was jarred by terse radio bulletins bringing fragmentary news of a Japanese attack on the American naval base at Pearl Harbor. War, a specter on campus for more than 2 years, was now a looming reality. 2 days after the devastation in Hawaii, a Maroon editorial described a campus where students mirror confusion, bewilderment. The editors sought to offer reassurance, telling their readers not to brood over the future or fall prey to a cynical, defeatist attitude. Their counsel was measured, recommending that until we are called to actual service, our most sensible course of action is to remain in school, because our active participation in this worldwide conflict is practically inevitable. Worrying won't remedy the situation. Better to buckle down and finish the academic year. Presuming to draw a lesson from the last war, they concluded, if we throw up the sponge and resign ourselves to indifference in the classroom throughout this crisis, we shall suffer the same fate as the lost generation of the 20s. Anxieties about the war, pervasive doubts about American involvement, and worries about the fate of European democracies had been building since well before Pearl Harbor. Throughout the 1930s, the campus had hosted a curious array of campus speakers, with faculty members and visitors offering divergent insights into the unfolding crises in Europe and Asia. In February 1933, Paul Jacobson, an instructor in history, told a chapel audience that Hitler's control of the government had already assumed the proportions of a political tyranny, aggravated by race hatred, class distinction, religious differences, and the economic crisis. Later that year, two German doctors, members of the Berlin Olympic Committee, visited Colgate on a mission to see how a successful collegiate athletic program was being run, taking in a hard-hitting Andy Kerr football practice. Meeting with students, the doctors, who were both members of the Nazi Party, reassured them that the war was highly improbable and rejected any assertion that Jews were being persecuted. 2 years later, Professor of German Clifford E. Gates, class of 1915, returned from his seventh trip to Germany and offered an astoundingly sanguine view of Hitler's success in reducing unemployment and rebuilding the nation's military capacity. He went on to describe the new beliefs which have sprung up to lead the German people forward, in particular, their belief in the superiority in the Nordic people. As for religious persecution, he maintained, when the members of a religious sect have been persecuted, it is because of their political ideas, not their religion. Any violence against the Jews is severely punished, he said. As the likelihood of war drew closer, visitors in 1940 included Republican Senator Gerald Nye of North Dakota, a mainstay of the America First movement. Nye, the architect of the Neutrality Acts of the 1930s, an Anglophobe, an anti-Semite, spoke to an audience of some 700 students in February. 3 months later, Morris Hendis, who had enjoyed his distinguished career as a journalist since graduating in 1915, returned to address a chapel crowd. He had visited Colgate regularly over the years, and on this occasion he had just returned from Prague, where he worked for CBS. Don't confuse yourselves and think the country will stay out, he warned in an emotional talk. If this war lasts 2 years, I'm almost certain this country will be involved as soon as Germany steps on American toes. Hendis spent 3 years in Russia during the war, reporting for the New York Herald Tribune. Among the other speakers offering perspective on global events as the clouds of war darkened was another alumnus, the Reverend Adam Clayton Powell, Jr., class of 1930. Already a dynamic presence in the pulpit, he was invited to address a chapel audience on the place of the Negro in the world today. In a world where democracy seemed to be vanishing, Powell argued, "We cannot crush a man without crushing our entire structure. The place of the Negro in American society must be that of an individual with political and social equality and the same right to live as others." At the end of the 1940 academic year, Wendell Willkie, a rising star in the GOP and a known advocate of intervention, gave the commencement address. Later that summer, Willkie became the Republican nominee for president. Before Pearl Harbor, campus sentiment, like the sentiment throughout the country, veered between poles of isolation and involvement. A maroon columnist captured the unease and perplexity a year and a half before Pearl Harbor. "Perhaps I am not qualified to write anything about the European situation, but I do feel qualified at least to tell my readers that I don't want to go to war. There are none of my readers who can convince me of a good reason for going to war. Show me enemy bombers over the U.S. or enemy troops in the U.S., and with a sad heart, I would fight for my country. But," he asked, "why must our president solemnly address the nation with a tone of impending disaster? Why the frenzied news broadcasts and screaming headlines? I see no reason why we cannot accept the fact that there is a war in Europe. They've had them over there for centuries." By June 1940, according to the Maroon, most students were convinced that the United States would be at war within months, and students would not be returning to campus in the fall. When classes did indeed resume in September, President Cotton, who had railed relentlessly against New Deal programs throughout the 1930s, set a decidedly partisan tone at the opening convocation. Speaking to a receptive and generally approving audience of students and parents, he decried not the fascist regimes in Europe, but the arrogant dictatorship created under the New Deal and what he labeled FDR's orgy of dissipation. Echoing American isolationists, he complained, "Peace pleas have attracted as little attention as Robert's rules of order." But as German and Japanese armies swept over Europe and Asia, Colgate took a tentative step toward assisting the nation's military preparations. In October 1940, under the auspices of the Civil Aeronautics Authority, a civilian pilot training program was established and a Colgate airport emblazoned "Home of the Flying Red Raiders" in maroon letters opened at a newly constructed hangar and expanded landing strip 5 miles north of campus on U.S. Route 20. 30 students were soon in training, receiving ground instruction and 35 hours of flight instruction in 3 Piper Cubs. More students joined the program in 1941, and even more signed up after the attack on Pearl Harbor. The landing strips and hangar were expanded in the spring. The airport intruded onto farmland owned by Grove Hinman, who gladly sacrificed his spring crop of peas and beans. "Plow them under," Hinman told a reporter in June 1942. "This is such a big thing that we can't stop for a few peas and beans. We've got to produce flyers who will lick Hitler and Hirohito. Nothing will stop us." By the end of the war, 500 students had passed through the CAA's civilian pilot training and its successor, the War Training Service. Similar activities were taking place on other campuses. Only days after Pearl Harbor, college presidents and deans, including representatives from Colgate, met with government officials in New York and Baltimore to discuss the role universities could play in the mobilization. The easy consensus was that colleges should abbreviate the academic year to free students for military training. In January 1942, the Colgate faculty voted to accelerate its spring term, allowing seniors to graduate in early May. They also added a summer term so that with 3 terms of 15 weeks each, juniors, who had expected to graduate in June 1943, would be able to graduate in December 1942. Subsequent classes, could hasten to finish their college work in 2 years and 8 months. But many Colgate students were already choosing to enlist. On a single day in March, 20 joined the Marines. When the new summer term began, there were only 604 students left on campus, leaving uncertain prospects for the fall term. But when 262 freshmen and 256 sophomores showed up for the fall semester, the student body totaled 873, only 15% lower than normal. Nevertheless, enrollment worries remained, especially with the increasing prospect that the age for call-up would drop from 20 to 18. As Cutten prepared to retire from the presidency in August, he warned the Board of Trustees, "Further adjustments and probably radical changes are to be expected." In February 1942, Everett Needham Case was appointed to succeed Cutten as Colgate's 9th president. Although he would not arrive until the fall, it would fall to the 41-year-old to navigate the perilous financial challenges of the war years, to salve the anxieties and growing restlessness of the student body, and to shape a wartime strategy for the university. A 1922 Princeton graduate, Case had studied European history at Cambridge and Harvard. After finishing his Ph.D. coursework at Harvard, but without completing his dissertation, he accepted a position in 1927 as assistant to Owen D. Young, the president of General Electric, founder of the Radio Corporation of America, sometime diplomat, and best known as the author of the Young Plan to reduce Germany's post-World War I reparations. During his 6 years as Young's protege at GE, Case worked with an NBC advisory council and authored a report on the educational uses of radio for the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching. He was well-connected, socially and politically, an independent Democrat, as he described himself. He also married the boss's daughter, Josephine Young, an accomplished poet and novelist who later wrote a short novel evocative of her time in Hamilton. In the mid-1930s, Case returned to Harvard to take a position as assistant professor in the Graduate School of Business Administration, where he taught economic policy, and in 1939, he was appointed assistant dean. Case was the third layman to be named president of Colgate, but the search committee took pains to be absolutely certain that at the very least they had found another Baptist. Board members pointedly asked several of Case's friends and associates what they knew of his religious background. They were assured of his Baptist faith. During the presidential search, the faculty also weighed in with thoughts about the personal characteristics they desired in a new leader. While hoping for someone with a distinguished academic background and an understanding of the value of liberal education, they wanted a president devoted to the ideal of democratic cooperation between faculty and administration, a veiled appeal for relief from Cutten's heavy hand. At the same time, they underscored their desire for a president who possessed a sympathetic understanding of certain aspects of the Colgate tradition, of the Christian heritage of the university, of its progressive academic ideals, and of the part which a balanced athletic program plays in the life of the college. Not long after Case's selection, Cutten offered a jovial endorsement of his young, prematurely bald successor, telling Time magazine, "No one ever heard of a bald-headed fool." It was clear from the outset that Case's presidency would mark a break with the Cutten years. A Syracuse newspaper reported that he seemed less like an academic than a man of the crisp, young executive type. A pipe smoker, more than one journalist noted the pipe, a piano player with a love for Bach and old Princeton songs, and an avid New York Giants baseball fan, he quickly proved he was not as strict about alcohol and tobacco as his predecessor. Faculty members noted that ashtrays had suddenly appeared on Merrill House tables. While some faculty were put off by his patrician bearing, Case, unlike his moralizing predecessor, struck up an easy rapport with students. He also planned to teach his Harvard course on the development of fiscal policy, as well as to collaborate with others on a brand new course for sophomores called The American Idea. At the mercy of Uncle Sam. Case's inauguration on September 24, 1942, coincided with the 125th anniversary of the gathering of Colgate's 13 founders. But that distant history was not on the minds of the people who overcame wartime travel restrictions and pressing duties in Washington to make their way to Hamilton. The occasion was more serious than celebratory. Among the honorary degree recipients was Chief Justice Harlan Stone and the former ambassador to Japan, Joseph Grew. On the eve of the inauguration, the ambassador spoke to students and faculty about the uneven course of the war in Asia. Another visitor, Princeton University President Harold Dodds, warned about the perilous moment confronting every all-male college and university in the country. Their very survival now depended on the mercy of Uncle Sam and his military advisors. Case was equally somber, announcing that three-quarters of those who had graduated in June were in the armed forces, and that 8 Colgate men had already died. That number was kept sorrowfully up to date in the typed text of his speech. He had crossed out a 7 to insert a handwritten 8. Approximately 1,000 alumni were then in uniform, but whatever gratitude he might have felt for their military service, he could not bring himself to think about the war as anything other than a catastrophe. "This war spells failure," he asserted in his inaugural address, "and America's educational system would have to bear some of the blame for what had transpired after the last war." The United States had withdrawn too abruptly from the world, in part because colleges had not been able to grasp the meaning of the power and responsibilities which attached to our newly acquired position of primacy, he said. While acknowledging that winning the war was the most urgent task at hand, he exhorted colleges to appraise what they had done before the war and to think hard about what they should do after it. War would accelerate change, especially in the realms of science and technology, and Case was confident that a liberal arts college could introduce its students to scientific disciplines and methods, giving them a glimpse of the continuing nature of the scientific process and its implications. But he saw great difficulties ahead for those teaching in the social sciences and humanities. To avoid yet another calamitous war, colleges would have to take on the task of preparing citizens, as he put it, to work effectively with those millions of human beings whose backgrounds and ways of living are so different from ours. In a national radio broadcast a month after his inauguration, at convocations on other campuses and in countless newspaper interviews during the war, Case continued to envision the role of the post-war college. But Case's most urgent priority after taking office was to make sure that his own institution survived the war itself. If 18- and 19-year-olds were soon to be subject to immediate call-up, the only students on campus by early 1943 were likely to be a few 17-year-old freshmen, men classified 4F, not eligible for service for physical reasons, conscientious objectors, and perhaps a handful of pre-med and science students whose studies had earned military deferments. Welcome relief, a reprieve at least, came in the autumn with the announcement of an Army-Navy college training program, which would allow seniors already enrolled in college and enlisted in the reserves to finish out an abbreviated academic year. They would be called for duty no earlier than spring 1943. Nearly 80% of Colgate's student body had already enlisted in the reserves, and President Case prodded students toward 100% enlistment. As a growing number of students signed up for the reserves, the Maroon campaign for the college to prepare students for the rigors of basic training. In November, after a student debate and a vote in the chapel, a physical training program was instituted under the command of a retired Army colonel, a veteran of both the Spanish-American War and World War I. Mustered into rifle platoons and 4 companies, the students assembled at 7:15 in the morning weekdays on Whitnall Field or in Huntington Gym in inclement weather for an hour of calisthenics and drills. Readying themselves for active duty, they ran up the ski slope, trained on a 400-yard commando course, and were soon learning to march while shouldering bolt-action wooden rifles. Fencing, boxing, survival swimming, and for some reason basketball were the sports intended to ready them for the rigors of basic training. William Reed, class of 18, director of physical education, declared the program the toughest of any liberal arts college in the country and a model for others to emulate. Student leaders were also looking for ways to temper the frivolous traditions and boisterous extracurricular pastimes of an all-male college. Freshmen, though still expected to wear their black ties and to say hello to everyone, would no longer be required to wear their beanies, the distinctive green lids that signified the newest arrivals on campus. Embarrassed by the levity of house parties, pep rallies, and bonfires, the Student Senate sought, usually in vain, to curtail the festivities and to quell some of the noisier student escapades in the village, including the habit of storming en masse past the ticket booth at the village movie house, Shines Theater. The Maroon took pains to criticize students who drove their cars on campus, wasting gas and wearing out their rubber tires, both of which were rationed. More consequential contributions were made to the war effort as fraternities competed to top one another in the purchase of war bonds. The debate team took on the task of traveling to nearby towns where they organized forums to discuss war aims on behalf of the War Information Bureau. Town and Gown also collaborated in running a USO canteen just off the village green. At the urging of the Maroon, student musical groups turned their attention to morale-boosting performances on campus and in the village. A new singing group took shape when a cluster of students began to harmonize informally at the Colgate Inn. The men, drawn from various fraternities, banded together and honored founding traditions by calling themselves the 13. The Maroon praised their singing and was prescient in predicting a bright future for them. Combining the advantages of a compact group with the enthusiasm of real music lovers, the newspaper opined, the 13 should spread far the name and songs of Colgate in coming years. Even athletic teams found a way to join the war efforts. In July 1942, the Colgate baseball team, augmented with several players from Syracuse and Cornell, took on the American Negro League's powerful Kansas City Monarchs and their star pitcher, Satchel Paige. Before a capacity crowd in Syracuse, Colgate lost 5-1, but the game raised $5,000 for the Red Cross. The box score showed Paige giving up 2 hits and striking out 9 in his 3 innings on the mound. That fall, the football team enjoyed one of its most successful seasons since the early 30s, shutting out a highly touted Syracuse team and losing only to Penn State and Duke, a game played in Buffalo to facilitate wartime travel. Whatever boost athletics gave to morale, Case and others on the faculty began to wonder whether college sports might need to be curtailed for the duration of the war. The classroom offered no haven from the war for either students or professors. The faculty contemplated how the curriculum might have to be reshaped to meet the demands of the conflict. After asking each academic department and school to weigh in on how they could contribute to a possible military curriculum, the Faculty Committee on the Emergency Revision of the Curriculum issued its report in October 1942. The committee seized upon guidance from Secretary of War Henry L. Stimson, who had outlined certain definite capacities which make a man valuable as a leader. Echoing much of what liberal arts colleges had always aimed to do, Stimson spoke about the military's need for men capable of clear and accurate expression and accurate mathematical computation, who possessed a basic familiarity with some exact science having a direct relationship to the problems of the Army. More practically, he encouraged colleges to teach students to deal realistically with maps and charts. Assessing Colgate's academic strengths, the faculty was convinced that the schools of physical science and biological science had the most to offer and were also the most likely to retain students. In fact, students majoring in the hard sciences and in pre-med programs were already receiving deferments. But the School of Social Sciences also saw immediate ways of serving military and civilian manpower needs. They had recently learned that economics majors were eligible for deferments, anticipating their roles as logistics and supply officers or in various war mobilization agencies in Washington. There were also sound reasons to increase the offerings in public administration, a growing field of study during the New Deal, and one that had been uppermost in mind when the Washington Study Group was created in 1935. They knew, too, that the military would need psychologists, just as it had in the last war. While the report judged that the School of Fine Arts and Philosophy and Religion were not directly tied up with the military effort and had very few majors, the report saw them as significant post-war assets, contending that these schools and departments would have to look to a more distant future, not merely the student of today, but the man of the next 40 years. But whatever emergency curriculum might emerge, the faculty was shrinking, with younger members drafted and others volunteering for war work. At least 20 members of the faculty and administration departed to take on military or civilian roles in 1942-43. Others were likely to be called up at any moment. As part of the mobilization, Dean of Students Carly Colgren, class of 1917, was asked by the government to survey the faculty and add their specific skills and expertise to the national roster of scientific and specialized personnel. By the end of the war, approximately 20% of the faculty had taken leave and departed for work in civilian agencies or the military. While the faculty was debating the military curriculum, President Case traveled to Washington, and by late fall had negotiated contracts that would soon transform Colgate from a liberal arts college into something more akin to a military base. After a Navy inspection team judged the campus shipshape and saw how well the civilian pilot training program had performed, Colgate was chosen as one of 20 colleges to house a naval flight preparatory school called the V-5 program. Headquartered on the Student Union's third floor, third deck in Navy jargon, the NFPS opened in January 1943 with the first 200 cadets unloaded from a troop train that had plowed its way from New York in a heavy snowstorm. The cadets had not yet been issued uniforms, had no textbooks, and for a time slept on the creaking floors of Eaton Hall, the old seminary building. But conditions soon improved, and the ranks of trainees expanded. By March, there were 600 NFPS cadets on campus, most of them recent high school graduates. The transition to the Navy program was overseen by Lieutenant Commander E. Trudeau Thomas, a Princeton graduate, Rhodes Scholar, and, conveniently, a college friend of President Case, as well as a member of his eating club at Princeton. Before the war, he had been headmaster of a prep school, and he quickly won the respect of the faculty and cadets. The 12-week NFPS curriculum, which included courses in principles of flying, navigation, aircraft engines, meteorology, communications, mechanical drawing, aircraft recognition, and aerology, the study of atmospheric conditions, as well as math and physics, bore little resemblance to that of a liberal arts college. But the government payments, $50 a month for each student's room and board, and $168 tuition, helped keep the college afloat. In May 1943, additional programs were announced, each newly arriving unit of trainees designated by a mutating series of letters and numbers. The Navy Reserve's V-1, V-7, and V-12 programs enabled students to begin or continue their college studies and receive the first phases of military training at the same time. They constituted pipelines into the officer ranks. During the summer of 1943, the 413 college students in the first V-12 unit included 300 students who were already enrolled at Colgate. As the NFPS cadets rotated through training, and as students in the various V programs were assigned to Colgate, the campus swelled to 1,300 students by summer 1943. Facilities were stretched to their limits. Civilian students, numbering just over 100 in 1943 and declining to a mere 70 in 1944, lived in the Theta Chi and Delta Upsilon houses, While the students destined for the Navy and Marines were housed in the remaining 11 fraternity houses and up on the hill. The Sigma Chi House served as the Navy infirmary. The final Navy program, designated V-7, began in July 1944 and ran until October 1945. It brought men to campus who, while on active duty with the fleet, had shown promise as officer material. Almost all had finished at least 2 years of college before the war, and a few held graduate degrees. Arriving on campus and taking placement tests, the Navy men were then assigned to 4, 8, or 12-week academic refresher courses, setting them on track for midshipman school and further specialized training. With diverse comings and goings, and their numbers seriously depleted, the faculty was forced to shift their teaching loads to cover for absent colleagues, and they faced a relentless cycle of 2- and 3-month courses. As faculty members struggled to staff the classroom, they found themselves teaching unaccustomed courses. In all, more than 50 professors were called on to teach in the NFPS program, and still others adapted their departmental offerings to Navy needs. The geology department taught courses on map reading, aerial photography, coastal defenses, and military engineering. The history department planned new courses on the historical background of the present war and global theaters of the present crisis. While Romance language instruction dwindled, the German department expanded its elementary courses and added a course in military German. At any one time, as many as 20 naval officers and a dozen enlisted men also cycled through Hamilton to teach, train, and oversee the cadets. While Navy instructors handled flight training and taught courses on engines and aircraft recognition, the Colgate faculty was nevertheless pulled very far afield. Claiming that impossible is a word all America is learning to avoid, psychology professor George H. Estabrooks wrote a morale-boosting article for the Saturday Evening Post recounting the ways the Colgate faculty was contributing to the war effort. He described what he termed a campus revolution, adding that the good old monastic idea of leisurely education is gone for the duration, perhaps forever. The military had taken over the campus, he reported, and the philosopher and sociologist must learn to teach navigation and physics. Compelled to bolster their shrinking ranks, the faculty had taken one step he called absolutely without precedent in Colgate's history. They had asked 4 women to join the faculty. They taught courses in communications, first aid, and mechanical drawing. He was prescient about the implications of their hiring and concluded that this departure probably represents a growing trend in the liberal arts college. He neglected to mention that the contingent of Navy officers included Wave Lieutenant Junior Grade Alice Crozier, whose 2 years at Colgate made her, in all likelihood, the longest-serving member of the Navy's training corps. With classes beginning at 7:30 for everyone, and physical training moved to mid-afternoon, there was little free time or leeway for slacking off. The dawdlers and the loafers will be called into active service as apprentice seamen at the end of the semester in which they fall from grace, a faculty member warned. Despite the military regimen, a semblance of college life was maintained. Intercollegiate athletic competition continued as teams filled out their rosters with men drawn from military units, some of them having played at other colleges and universities. Intramurals were also hotly contested, especially between Navy and Marine training units. Lectures, concerts, and other entertainment continued. And campus publications, both the Maroon and Banter, the college humor magazine, were handed over to editorial boards dominated by military trainees. Their tone changed as they added news articles about the fighting in Asia and Europe, published messages from Colgate men wherever they served, and issued official bulletins about the arrivals and transfers of military units. The titles of the Maroon columns, Boondock Bits, Strictly Scuttlebutt, Conning Tower, Flash and Facts, and for the Marines, Beat Your Chops, Joe, captured both the gung-ho military spirit and predictable GI grumblings. By the fall of 1944, when the program finally began to wind down, 2,477 cadets had graduated from the NFPS program and gone on to flight school. Between 1943 and the departure of the last V-12 unit in 1946, Colgate taught 1,137 prospective officers, 736 of them in the Navy and 401 Marines. The V-7 program brought another 848 enlisted seamen to campus for academic refresher courses. The V-12 and V-7 men were in essence doing regular college work, although the curriculum was considerably heavier in math and physics than a typical liberal arts science major would have taken. In 1944, Colgate promised the members of both programs that they would be welcome to return after they finished their military service and would receive full college credit for their wartime academic work. Professor of Chemistry Sidney French, coordinator of the NFPS program, kept close tabs on the college's relative performance in the NFPS to see how Colgate compared with other institutions, including larger research universities and engineering schools. Analyzing test scores from 17 NFPS programs across the country, he found Colgate consistently ranked second, usually behind either RPI or Cal Poly, and much to his satisfaction, well ahead of Williams, Wesleyan, and Penn. The liberal arts college has stood up to its somewhat unnatural job surprisingly well, he reported. Distinctly unnatural for a liberal arts college was the job of sending so many students off to war. At his first wartime commencement in December 1942, Case bade farewell to a senior class numbering only 184. Because 30 reservists had been ordered to report for duty before Christmas, some in the class thought it inappropriate to hold the ceremony in the absence of so many classmates. They lobbied to cancel it altogether, maintaining that everyone should have a chance to spend a few days at home during the holidays. Instead, graduation was hurriedly rescheduled for December 13, just over a year after the attack on Pearl Harbor. Arrangements were made for families to travel to Hamilton from as far away as Illinois and Texas, despite gas rationing, restrictions on civilian train travel, and cramped housing in the village. It was a somber occasion, remembered years later by Josephine Case in an article for the Atlantic Monthly. Awaking to the scraping of snowplows early on the morning of what she dubbed the White Commencement, and knowing how emotionally draining her husband's preparation for the ceremony had been, she wondered, what could one say to boys setting out upon such errands as these, boys for whom one felt such affection, such apprehension? In the chapel, standing before the college's service flag, with its field of blue and gold stars, President Case spoke more slowly and deliberately than usual, as he cautioned the graduates that war would be the very antithesis of much that you have been taught. He painted a stark contrast between their lives as students and what they were about to face. Many of the things you will have to see and do are so far removed from the gentle precepts of a civilized home and a liberal college as to make high-sounding slogans about the purposes of the war seem screaming and mocking insults. He had begun his talk by reminding the graduates of Socrates' military service, an account related in Plato's Apology, a dialogue many students had no doubt read. Having risked death and survived three battles, Socrates returned to Athens and proved no less willing to sacrifice himself in the peacetime pursuit of wisdom, acting as a civic gadfly, questioning, testing, and relentlessly annoying his fellow citizens. As Case so often did in his wartime speeches, he spoke of the inevitability of peace and focused the graduates' attention on the obligations they too would face when they returned. He ended with an exhortation to virtue, suggesting that the traits called upon in war, essential as they would be, should not upend the values that would be paramount in rebuilding a peaceful world. War scarcely seems to affect the starry firmament without, nor does it turn completely upside down the moral law within, he reminded them. On certain of the virtues it sets particular store, courage, self-reliance, loyalty, teamwork, and sometimes even initiative. Cultivate these virtues, then, but never forget that the virtues consistent with the effective prosecution of anything so ruthless and destructive as war will hardly be sufficient to assure the peaceful reconstruction of the world. As they crossed the chapel stage to receive their diplomas and bachelor's hoods, Case had quiet parting words for each. This would be the largest graduating class and the last to raise their torches around the banks of Taylor Lake and sing the alma mater, until 1947. Many of the wartime graduating classes would be so small that the ceremonies could be hosted at the president's house. All the farewells took on a military aura, as did the ceremony in June 1945, when the graduates included 3 V-12 men, 2 Navy veterans, 3 seniors with medical school deferments, and only 5 civilians. Of the 3,740 Colgate graduates who served in World War II, more than half of all the alumni then alive, 141 did not survive the war. And 13 names on the memorial roster were those of the men who had received their diplomas in December 1942 at the White Commencement. Post-war plans. The war transformed Colgate from a liberal arts college into a military training ground. The influx of military students and the infusion of government-paid tuition kept the all-male college open during the war, even while President Case's wartime speeches looked toward the peacetime college. When he arrived in 1942, amid countless uncertainties, Case claimed to have no blueprint for educational reform. But the war prompted him to think more deeply about the shortcomings of American higher education. Case saw an opportunity for reform as the war shattered inertia and routine on campuses everywhere and stirred up a healthy mood of self-criticism and a disposition to re-examine educational ends and means, he said. The war was an occasion for considered, and it may be daring, study and experiment in general education at the college level. With so few civilian students on campus and many of the courses of the Colgate Plan going unstaffed and untaught, the time was ripe for rethinking the curriculum. Case wasted little time in appointing a committee on the post-war college, convening its first meetings in the spring of 1943. To focus their discussions, Case ventured a memorandum with his own self-styled presumptuous proposals for curricular reform. He invited the faculty to debate his ideas, announcing he would skip the meeting so they could hold a free and critical discussion. His memo expressed dismay at what he had often seen in the years before the war, when parents pushed their sons and daughters to enroll in peripheral or superficial courses designed with an eye to the current market. He was also wary of courses on American citizenship and democratic institutions, like those created at many colleges during and immediately after World War I. In fact, he was wary of courses in and of themselves, arguing that what was needed was not a disjointed series of classes, but a true curriculum, a unified 4-year course of study. Befitting a historian, his proposed curriculum was primarily historical, beginning with a search for the roots of Western civilization, which, in the freshman and sophomore years, would focus on the ancient and medieval world before turning to the modern world and more specialized work during the last 2 years in science, literature, economics, and philosophy. Its aim over 4 years would be to instill a strong sense of responsibility for participation in community affairs, whether students chose to embark on careers in the public or private sector. This sense of responsibility is basic, and no liberal education deserves the name which fails to nourish and cultivate it, he wrote. The committee members embraced Case's general statements about the aims of a liberal education, but they knew that determining the content and structure of what they readily termed a common core was a difficult task.
The Colgate plan that had emerged in the 1930s, the five surveys, the preceptorial system, and comprehensive exams, had been a valiant effort to create a more coherent and better integrated curriculum as knowledge expanded in different fields and academic disciplines grew more specialized. But after assessing its decade-long experience with the survey courses, Colgate's committee on the post-war college was dissatisfied with the superficiality of the survey approach. Case described it as a cook's tour with the students as passengers.
While the faculty treated Case's recommendations for historical content politely, they were circumspect about the amount of time he wanted to devote to the ancient and medieval worlds, and dubious, too, that his sweeping chronological structure would provide the focus and unity he hoped to achieve. There was a bookish air to Case's proposal, a scent of medieval scholasticism. The past is, of course, not irrelevant, and books still have a useful function, they said. But the past and the books in which it is enshrined are recognized as means, not ends. The question committee members raised concerned the continuity between the college curriculum and the outside world of affairs. Although it had been suspended during the war years, the Washington Study Group exemplified to the faculty how the gap between college studies and the real world of public policymaking and administration could be bridged. The committee members' vision of the post-war college was one that would extend the laboratory or fieldwork principle, wherever feasible, and would create situations where the learning from books is subordinated and vitalized by practical experience or at least by first-hand observation of practical affairs. Over the next 2 years, members of the faculty, administration, and a student committee would submit their own presumptuous proposals, sometimes extending their ideas beyond curricular boundaries to assess campus social life, athletics, and admissions. Some wanted a post-war curriculum that would focus on America's widening global role. As the acting dean of faculty, Sidney French, put it, "No greater job faces liberal arts colleges than that of training future citizens to understand not only themselves and their country, but Europeans, Asiatics, and South Americans. To accomplish this in full measure would require travel in these areas, teachers familiar by actual contact with these cultures, a breadth of sympathetic understanding of the problems so unlike our own, and a forsaking of our fundamentally nationalistic desires." The committee solicited a report on the emerging interdisciplinary approaches to area studies. One faculty member offered a specific recommendation to add courses in the Russian, Chinese, and Korean languages. He also advocated a greater emphasis on music because he predicted the United States would replace Europe as the music center of the world. He bolstered his argument for the arts with a utilitarian claim suggesting that music would help in the rehabilitation of wounded soldiers.
The student committee, four members chosen from the classes of 1944 and 45, was completely unconstrained in its criticisms in a sweeping 23-page broadside to President Case. Having gone through the faculty roster one by one, the student complainants named names, singling out individual faculty members for poor teaching and conducting classes as if administering an anesthetic. As they reviewed the courses on offer, they contended that the college catalog was utterly deceptive in its course descriptions. They recommended increased rigor in most courses and the immediate elimination of notoriously easy courses, which they called pipe courses, noting that a lazy student could graduate with almost no mental exertion during the entire 4 years. They conceded that fraternities served an important molding influence to the individual and were, in fact, preferable to other residential systems. Nevertheless, they saw a need for reform, asserting that the fraternities were morally rotten.
They based their criticisms on their knowledge of pledge parties that involved visits to the brothels in Utica or Syracuse, and pig parties, as they call them, that took place in the fraternity houses. Claiming that administrators had turned their backs on what was common knowledge, the students appealed to the college to tighten the enforcement of college regulations and no longer hide behind a protective form of ignorance. They charged the dean with being extremely and detrimentally lax with regard to student discipline, and called for the faculty to improve its monitoring of fraternities. They felt that for too long the faculty had insisted on remaining aloof and refused to take more than a passive interest in the fraternities and their functions. Again, they named names, indicting one member of the class of 1945 for being frequently drunk, owning a car illegally, having smashed up that car more than once, being jailed for a hit-and-run crash, and bringing gamblers to campus, among other even less savory activities. Not surprisingly, they concluded that higher admission standards were in order, with better screening with regard to scholarship and to character, and more weeding out of the chaff in the freshman and sophomore years. Having received ideas from many quarters, the post-war committee submitted its preliminary recommendations on the curriculum to the full faculty in October 1944 and forwarded copies to colleagues who were still away on wartime duties, as well as to key alumni and educators on other campuses. The report posited that Colgate would remain a liberal arts college, with the committee reaffirming the college's historic mission of awakening young men to their cultural heritage and to their individual responsibilities and social obligations. Vocational training would remain incidental and subordinate to the university's primary purpose, which the committee defined as the broadening and maturing of the individual student's intellectual life. Throughout its pages, the report rang changes on themes of moral responsibility, contending that the ultimate aim of college was to foster social awareness, community participation, and effective membership in a society of free men. Most who read the report weighed in approvingly. Professor of Philosophy Eugene T. Adams was serving at the Corpus Christi Air Station when he wrote to Dean French, "I am all for going whole hog on making Colgate a place where we educate people for world citizenship, and I don't think we should have to apologize for having such fancy ambitions. I think education might be defined as a serious and sustained attempt to overcome provincialism. If the world is our stage, as apparently it must be, nothing short of worldwide understanding is good enough." He also urged the university to make plans for a continuous interchange of students and faculty with foreign universities. Almost every other college in the country was discussing educational reforms, producing a veritable downpour of books and articles, as Harvard's president James B. Conant asserted in the introduction to his university's widely heralded report, General Education in a Free Society, also known as the Red Book. Harvard, Yale, Amherst, Minnesota, and many other colleges were contemplating general education, which Harvard's report defined as that part of a student's whole education which looks first of all to his life as a responsible human being and citizen. In preparing its 1944 report on the core curriculum, the Colgate faculty also remarked on the reform efforts across the country and took special notice of the movement toward increasing the amount of prescribed work.
On many campuses, the reasons for doing so were familiar and well rehearsed. Reformers predicated their ideas about general education on two convictions. First, that there were certain areas of information that an educated person should know, or at least should be exposed to. And second, that colleges should introduce students to the wares of the various departments, enabling them to make better choices about their majors and about their careers.
The discussions at Colgate turned away from these arguments to tackle head-on what the committee believed was a more significant underlying fact, namely the increasing specialization and autonomy of academic departments. Teaching experiences at Colgate during the war had cast specialization in a new light, pushing faculty to transcend their accustomed academic training and compelling greater internal cooperation across departmental lines. For Colgate faculty, the war had opened up a cross-disciplinary conversation about general education, paving the way for the new core curriculum. The committee framed the curricular challenges as finding some body of work that belongs to the whole university that may stand as a core of general education. The committee sought to make a college education something more than a collection of courses, no matter how well distributed among diverse departments. Worried that introductory courses based in individual academic disciplines too often carried the accent of graduate study, it also sought some sort of pedagogic consistency. If the courses of the core curriculum can be taught from the same or at least from comparable and complementary points of view, and if some effort at integration is made, especially in the later years, some progress will be made toward helping students make a coherent whole of their work, they reported. The Colgate plan of the 1930s, with its six separate schools, was intended to bring together related clusters of academic disciplines. In contrast, the post-war reforms sought a deeper integration of the curriculum than the separately led schools had allowed. Case explained the new approach as a curriculum which is frankly and deliberately built around a core of prescribed and intimately related courses to be organized and administered under university rather than departmental auspices. A new division of university studies was born along with the core. But with the end of the war in view and military manpower needs rapidly declining, the college faced graver and more immediate challenges in the transition to peace. The CAA war training service units were eliminated in summer 1944, and the NFPS program was expected to wrap up by the fall. While the V-7 and V-12 programs continued, the Navy was assigning far fewer men to campus. Anticipating enrollment for fall 1944 was only going to be about 500 students, 60 to 80 civilians, and perhaps 450 in the remaining Navy and Marine programs. For the spring, there were likely to be only 400 students on campus, generating about half the previous year's revenue. While certain economies could be found, especially with so many faculty still away and lighter demands on campus facilities, the trustees feared that the university would have to draw more heavily on its endowment. To everyone's surprise, however, alumni donations to the annual fund had remained strong during the war, managing even to set a record in 1943. Given an impending deficit, though, of some $300,000, the Alumni Corporation promised to pitch in to contribute even more, aiming to double pre-war donations. Case himself was optimistic that there are still men of means in this country who are interested or can be interested in the future of our colleges. It is imperative, in my judgment, that we make something more than haphazard efforts to interest such individuals in the future of Colgate. The most pressing needs, as the war drew to a close, were to recruit a talented student body and to prepare for the returning veterans. While veterans' benefits would help some men attend college in the near term, the long-term task of making college affordable to a wider swath of the population required more scholarship money. The faculty, some of whom felt the college was handicapped by a reputation for attracting fast students, hoped that scholarships would attract better qualified and more serious students, thus curtailing the social fun and games that had prevailed on the campus in the 1930s. Despite all the efforts to raise academic standards in the 1920s, the Great Depression had forced Colgate to admit less capable students, and the college could not afford to forego tuition revenue by kicking out students who were indifferent to their academic work. Austin Colgate's 1931 bequest to establish a four-year scholarship bearing his name was a model on which the post-war scholarship plans could build. His fund already supported 18 students, all of whom had to be in the top half of their class, which set an academic standard, though not an especially demanding one. There had been other efforts in the mid-1930s, unrealized given the fiscal constraints of the Depression, to attract more talented students. During the war, with fundraising holding strong, an opportunity to expand scholarship support took shape as alumni donors looked for a way to remember the Colgate men lost in the two world wars. In 1944, the Alumni Corporation proposed that a new scholarship program have first claim on the annual fund and that it serve as a living memorial to those killed in the wars. The Alumni War Memorial Scholarships were born. And in July, the Maroon described a program in which 13 regional and 13 national scholars would be selected on the basis of the candidates' character, performance, and promise as leaders. The first group was chosen in 1946, and the program has continued to be one of the highest honors an entering student can receive. President Case and his colleagues also knew that the faculty would have to be rebuilt and expanded at a moment when, with college enrollments likely to grow thanks to the GI Bill, there would be an all-out national competition to recruit younger faculty members. There were predictions that the ranks of the professoriate might require as many as 250,000 new PhDs in the 1950s and 1960s. Colgate was not well positioned to compete, since its salary still lagged well behind top-tier liberal arts colleges and research universities. The starting salary for an instructor was $2,400, lower pay than many high school teachers could command. The good news was that the campus's physical needs, thanks to President Cutten's building efforts in the 1920s, were relatively modest. A new infirmary was the most urgent requirement, and some hoped that a community hospital could be included in the money raising. Case was especially interested in the community hospital, envisioning it as an experiment in demonstrating what a college might accomplish in the field of rural health. Topping the list of other post-war needs was a new library and conversion of the aging library into a foreign language center. Case also expressed hope that an arts center with adequate performance space for concerts and plays might be built in the near future. Other building projects could be deferred. Whatever additional resources might come the university's way would be used to bolster faculty salaries. The war changed expectations about what American higher education could contribute to the post-war world. The two world wars had accelerated scientific and technological advances, both the horrific and the life-saving. World War II forged a tighter bond between research, universities, and government that was further strengthened during the Cold War. The Manhattan Project, with its team of renowned scientists, is no doubt the best-known collaboration, but academics in every field brought their knowledge to bear on the war effort, though not all are equally well-remembered. For example, the Ethnogeographic Board and its rapid mobilization of some 5,000 anthropologists, linguists, economists, historians, and many others in the social sciences and humanities is largely forgotten. While the majority of Colgate's faculty members had made contributions to the war through their teaching on campus, others had ranged far and wide. As the war wound down in spring 1945, Clifford Gates and Karl Mundt were dispatched to Germany by the War Department. Paul Farmer and James Storing were at work with the UN Relief and Rehabilitation Agency. Albert Garrison was in Europe as Deputy Chief of Intelligence at the Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force. Douglas Redding was in the Office of Strategic Services. A half dozen other faculty members, including Professor of Philosophy Eugene T. Adams and History Department Chairman Charles R. Wilson, were asked to go to Shrivenham in England and to Fontainebleau and Biarritz in France, where the Army had set up its university study centers so that troops awaiting discharge could begin to resume their educations and preparations for civilian life. Some faculty members involved in the war effort also looked ahead to novel research opportunities and anticipated new streams of funding from private philanthropy, government agencies, and corporations. Professors George Easterbrooks, Clarence Young, and F. Kenneth Berrien were doing work for the Acoustical Materials Association on noise reduction in manufacturing plants and its impact on worker productivity, safety, and comfort. Others in the social sciences were planning a project on freedom of association. While individual scholars had been productive before the war, the new landscape led the faculty in 1944 to establish the Research Council. Its aim was to stimulate and coordinate research and productive scholarship, but as Case explained to the board, it would also see that such activities are carried on not at the expense of teaching, but rather in order to enrich it. Colgate was not on the verge of joining the ranks of major research universities, but the war had given its faculty new perspectives on both research and teaching. The more immediate challenge, however, was to prepare for the returning veterans. Homecoming. In 1945, 16 million U.S. veterans faced discharge from military service and a return to civilian life. Many were uneasy about their futures. Some worried about the jobs they had left. Some were bedeviled by memories of Depression-era unemployment. Many others had seen their educations interrupted by the war. Military service had earned veterans a cluster of benefits, all embodied in the Servicemen's Readjustment Act of 1944, popularly known as the GI Bill of Rights. The law made a year of unemployment insurance available to returning veterans, offered loan guarantees for those yearning to purchase homes or farms or to start businesses, and promised funding for vocational training and higher education. Roughly half of the nation's veterans took advantage of the educational and training benefits, 2.2 million of them deciding to enroll in college. The landscape of higher education would be dramatically altered by this flood of veterans. In 1947, 49% of the nation's college students were veterans. Thanks to the GI Bill, access to higher education expanded, with male college enrollment doubling in the immediate aftermath of the war and continuing to rise throughout the 1950s. When Colgate began the academic year in 1946, there were 1,392 students on campus. The average age of entering students was 20, the oldest was 28, and three-quarters of them were veterans.
In planning for the returning veterans, the university had decided in 1944, despite lingering enrollment worries, that it would not alter its traditional educational objectives to attract students, nor would it go out of its way to offer vocational or technical training to veterans. However, the faculty did take time to confer with the Veterans Administration and other colleges about the services veterans might need and what accommodations would have to be made as they returned to civilian life.
Psychology professor Esther Brooks was named Director of Veterans Affairs, serving as liaison to the Veterans Administration and to an array of veterans organizations, while also confronting problems on campus such as housing, especially for married men, tuition benefits, counseling, and medical services. Esther Brooks' duties also included working with the alumni office to identify counselors in various communities who could help Colgate alumni who had been wounded, or to assist families whose sons had been killed. On campus, most servicemen would need time to adjust to the classroom and academic work. For some, their discharge from the military might not make for a timely arrival at the beginning of a semester. Thus, Colgate developed tutorials and refresher courses and proved to be flexible about veterans' course requirements and credit hours. Knowing that most were older and eager to graduate quickly and get on with their lives, the faculty was attuned to placing them at more advanced levels after assessing their military training and experience. In tailoring the individual academic work for veterans, the university appointed Professor of Political Science James A. Storing to be Director of Studies for Veterans and designated a cluster of faculty members to serve as advisors, most of whom had also served in the military. All of Colgate's veterans were able to take advantage of a new employment office that opened in New York City, overseen by Professor of German Clifford Gates. Some of the veterans returned to school with wives and families. Anticipating this, the trustees agreed in 1945 that wives would be permitted to take courses and receive academic credit for their work, though the women would not be eligible to receive Colgate degrees, even though they paid tuition. In March 1946, when Helen Mews enrolled, she was the first of five women to start classes that month. The university issued a glowing press release about the 25-year-old former WAVE, a yeoman second class, who had married a former Colgate V-12 student. Two of the others were also WAVE veterans in their 20s, declaring them typical co-eds and taking special care to note their physical appearance. All were brunettes and, like many female students of their era, tended to be attired in sweaters, skirts, anklets, and loafers. The press release and accompanying photographs were picked up by newspapers around the country. The five students were presumed, inaccurately, to be the first women students in the 127-year history of Colgate, which was characterized by the press, not so inaccurately, as a strictly masculine institution. In interviews, the women voiced worries that their first days on campus would be agonizing, having no glimmer of how the men would react to their presence in the classroom. But Helen Mews, who was pictured in newspapers smiling and signing autographs while surrounded by the men in her history and German classes, remarked after her first few days on campus, "They are very nice, and never once have they been guilty of staring." Spring 1946 saw 95 married veterans in Hamilton, many of them assigned to live in East Hall or in the Lambda Chi or Kappa Delta row houses. By late spring, more suitable housing for married students, dubbed Vetville, sprang up at record speed on College Street across from the football field. After the college prepared the site at a cost of $12,000, 40 war surplus living units were transported to Hamilton. With several apartments in each, there were soon 133 apartments, with rents averaging $25 per month. They were fully occupied by autumn. The government spent $187,000 to erect Vetville, and modest amenities, a grocery store and three telephone booths, made married student life a little easier. Built to be portable, the houses were gradually sold to local homeowners, dismantled, and moved to other sites, the last ones still on campus as late as 1961. In the summer of 1946, another newly discharged veteran arrived in Hamilton as an instructor in the history department. Marvin Wachman's appointment was one sign, among many others, that the war had marked an advance in the painfully slow process of dismantling religious and racial barriers. A year earlier, at the American Army University Center in Biarritz, the chairman of Colgate's history department, Charles R. Wilson, had met Wachman, a 28-year-old combat infantry sergeant who also happened to hold a Ph.D. from the University of Illinois. After returning to the States and learning that Wachman was back home looking for work, Wilson immediately offered him a job. Wachman, Colgate's first Jewish faculty member, soon found himself in a classroom where every chair was filled by fellow veterans. In his 15 years at Colgate, he later said his bond with these students would never again be matched. His rapport with many faculty colleagues seems to have been equally strong. He settled into his teaching routine and in his second year on the faculty began to coach the freshman tennis team. He had been a collegiate star as an undergraduate at Northwestern University, and tennis continued to give him entree to wider social circles, including occasional calls from President Case to meet him at the courts. While most of Wachman's teaching was in American history, he soon helped to shape the evolving core curriculum.
As the war drew to a close, planning for the post-war college was well along. In a speech to the Academy of Political Science in April 1945, 4 months before atomic bombs were detonated over Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Case warned that the means of wholesale self-destruction were at hand. And he asked, "How are we to secure and harness for humanity the vast powers which science discovers and releases, but cannot and does not pretend to control? Government support for projects in the natural and physical sciences during the war had yielded rich harvests, but these scientific accomplishments posed extraordinary social and moral challenges."
In August 1945, The moral and intellectual shockwaves from Hiroshima and Nagasaki gave further impetus to curricular discussions. At the dawning of the nuclear age, President Case appointed a faculty committee on atomic energy, which promptly added its voice to the conversation about the post-war college. "The bomb," their report intoned, "has shattered more than things physical. The members weighed in on both educational issues and national policies, urging the United States to take the lead in negotiating post-war arms reductions and fostering scientific cooperation with other nations, including the Soviet Union. They hoped that these efforts would ultimately yield peaceful uses of atomic energy." Their report also offered a ringing endorsement of international education as a means of promoting mutual understanding, convinced that, despite differences of belief and institutions, peoples can be united through awareness of common frailties and aspirations. Approved unanimously by the faculty, the report concluded, "The bomb has exploded any illusion that one department of knowledge can safely be cultivated in isolation and thrown into startling relief the failure of man's moral conscience and social intelligence to keep pace with the giant stride of his science and technology." Augmenting the recommendations of the Committee on the Postwar College, the Atomic Energy Committee calls specifically for courses in Russian and Asian languages and cultures, more extensive exchanges of students and professors with foreign universities, and outreach to the local community to educate local citizens about the issues the world would face as a result of the atomic bomb. Outreach to the local community had begun in 1943 when Raymond O. Rockwood, an assistant professor of history, organized the Hamilton Community Forum. He continued those efforts after the war and also played a prominent role in a statewide movement for civic education under the auspices of the New York State Citizens Council. Viewing 1945 as the most memorable single year in recorded history, President Case told the board that the totality of the year's events marked the inescapable point of departure for discussions of education. Education was not a curious process which operates in a vacuum, he reminded them. Liberal arts colleges, no less than research universities, would have to consider their post-war roles. While the nation would certainly need able scientists, Case maintained, it would also require liberally educated men, responsibly aware of human history, human problems, and human potentialities. Whether one looks at industry or government or the organization of the peace, the critical problems are not technical, but human and social. Their solution depends upon character, responsible intelligence, and a capacity to see in clear perspective the complex relationships and the social and moral values of an imposing array of factors. Thus, effective general education becomes not less important, but more, and the role of the liberal college is not peripheral, but central.